Parshas Yisro. Vayishma Yisro Kohen Midyan, and Yisro the priest of Midyan heard. Who was Yisro? The pasuk goes on to say, Kohen Chosein Moshe, the father-in-law of Moshe. Here it is, Kol Asha Asa Elokim LeMoshe Yisrael. He heard all that Hashem did to Moshe and Yisrael. Ki Hotzi Hashem Yisrael Mitzrayim, because Hashem took Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. Now, we're being introduced to a person that we've seen before. We've seen him by a different name. This is, you know, the father of Tzipora, the wife of Moshe. Earlier, he's called Reuel. Rashi explains to us he has seven names. Here, he's called Yisro. And, in fact, the parasha of the Torah is called Yisro because he was considered a great individual. And the pasuk says, Vayishma Yisro, he heard. What did he hear? Rashi explains that he heard Kriyas Yamsuf u'Melchamas Amalek. The entire world heard about what Hashem had done. When Hashem took the Jewish nation out of Mitzrayim, Hashem did it in a very overt, very obvious manner. The Ramban, in the end of Parshas Bo, explains to us that one time in history, Hashem was demonstrating to the world, I am the creator, maintainer, and orchestrator of all physicality. That one time was Yetzias Mitzrayim, and the objective there was twofold. Obviously, rescuing the Jewish people, but additionally, showing the world, I am the creator, I am Hashem. And because of that, it wasn't just Mitzrayim that saw the various miracles. The entire world was informed. Everyone knew about it. Interestingly, the Torah tells us one man came, because despite how obvious it was and despite how clear it was, most people just let it be. But Yisro heard and he came. He wanted to be Megayer. He wanted to join the Jewish people. He came. But Rashi explains to us what moved him. You see, everyone heard the story. Everyone heard the various details. Everyone was aware of what happened. But what moved Yisro, explains Rashi, Kriyas Yamsuf and Melchamas Amalek. Two parts. One is that when the Jewish people camped on the sea, Hashem split the Yamsuf. And number two, very shortly thereafter, Amalek attacked and Hashem saved us. Now, this Rashi is a bit curious. Why? Because there were a multitude of miracles that Hashem revealed when taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim. Every one of them was tremendous. Dam, Sfardeya, Kinim, Orv. You go through the Makkas, you see tremendous divine revelation. The pinnacle of them all, the greatest Mofes of all Mofsim, was Kriyas Yamsuf. By far, outshines, now pales every one of them. And all the other Nisim, while great and unimaginable, do not enter into the league of Kriyas Yamsuf. The Be'er, the water, the Mun, the Anonim were all great, but none of them compared. So I understand why Rashi would say that Kriyas Yamsuf really got Yisrael. Oh my goodness, the sea, the entire sea, the ocean split into 12 separate compartments, the entire Jewish nation marching in, the Mitzrayim being held at bay, and then right when the Jews get to that point, the Mitzrayim are let in. The entire scenario was so miraculous, beyond anything ever done before, that it would make sense why that would move Yisro so much that he would come and say, I want to be part of this nation, I want to be in Hashem's camp. But there's a second thing that moved him, Amalek. Now, of all the miracles that happened, the smallest by far was a war with Amalek. It was a war that was fought with swords and shields in the way of regular wars. As a matter of fact, you could look at that war and say there was nothing miraculous at all. The Jews far outnumbered the Amalekim. They were armed. They fought a battle, and they won the battle. Was it a miracle? Okay, Moshe Rabbeinu davened, and that's when he raised his hands, they won. When he lowered his hands, they would lose. Fine. But at the end of the day, of all the miracles, it's the smallest. It doesn't compare to a rock that follows the Jewish nation throughout their travels in the desert. A rock that spews forth not a gallon or two of water a day, but millions and millions of gallons of water. Rocks do not pour forth water. But this rock not only followed the Jews wherever they went, gallons and millions of, there were 3 million people in the Midbar. That means we're talking a river coming out from this rock. What about mun every day falling at the doorstep, exactly the right amount for that man, depending on his madrega? If you go through the Anonim, cleaning out their clothing, bringing them where they should, if you go through the miracles, and certainly if you go through Dam Tzadei Kinim, you'll quickly see that Amalek doesn't even compare. It's the smallest of the miracles, and it's the one sort of thing that you would assume is not a miracle at all. And therefore, the question on Rashi is, I understand why Kriyas Yamsuf moved Yisro. Oh, my goodness. But Amalek, that sounds like the smallest. Why is Rashi telling us that out of all the miracles, it was Kriyas Yamsuf and Amalek? Amalek doesn't seem to fit into the equation. And I believe the answer to this question is that some things require perspective. Rabbi Dvoritz Shiva Rochester once made an interesting observation. When you study the Holocaust, one of the difficulties is the enormity of the loss, 6 million people. But 6 million people is such a large number that it's hard to feel. It's just too big. And he says, if you really want to study the Holocaust, a good idea is to read a personal diary. Read one child's story, one man's story, one woman's story, and you'll feel the pain. You'll feel the terror, the loss. When you feel that pain, then it's much easier to extrapolate out. Then you could feel what 6 million meant. But you can't start the other way. And sometimes it is that when things are so large, so overwhelming, we don't feel it as much. I believe what Rashi is sharing with us is that Yisro said, oh my goodness, Amalek, I know them, a mighty powerful nation. Hashem saved the Jews even from them? Yisro, that's nothing. That's nothing compared to Kriyas Yamsuf. But it was something, Tim. Why? Because that was real. He could touch the power. He could relate to them. He knew Amalek. Maybe he fought wars before with Amalek, but he certainly knew them as battle-ready warriors. And that's frightening. Even though, obviously, it pales in comparison as a nace, but it was more real to him, more in his world, and he was able to feel it. And I believe what Rashi is sharing with us is a very deep point. There's a line in Slichos that for many years caused me to wonder. Ki b'chol malchus agayim, amongst all the kings of the nation, me'en kamocha, Hashem, there's no one like you. Hashem, of all the kings that ever lived, there's no one like you. That does not sound like a compliment. That sounds like a major insult. You say to Hashem, of all the mortal, flesh and blood, weak kings who you created and put for a little while, none of them compare to you. What does that mean? Of course they didn't compare to him. Hashem is creator of the heavens and earth. Of course they didn't compare. What kind of compliment is that? But you see, that's the point. I live in a very tactile, flesh and blood world. I live in a concrete world. I see a king, mighty and powerful. Oh my goodness. And Hashem is even more powerful than him. Oh, now I feel it. Now it's real. Telling me that Hashem rules over 100 billion galaxies isn't real. I don't feel it. I don't touch it. It's too distant, too abstract. Tell me that Hashem is even more powerful than Arnold Schwarzenegger. Oh my goodness, even more powerful than Arnold Schwarzenegger. Wow. Come on, that's something? Yeah, because I can feel his strength. And if I saw him lift up something heavy and I recognize Hashem is stronger than that, then at least I can feel it. Obviously, the goal is not to stop there. But again, I think it's an interesting illustration of how the human works. And oftentimes, we need concrete things. Sometimes it's the small little things that let us recognize Hashem's power. When we recognize that our parnos is dependent on Hashem. In the scheme of things, that's nothing compared to my sabrashis. But when I get it, that whether I live or die, am healthy or well, if I earn a living or not, is in Hashem's hand, Hashem's really powerful. Does that compare to creating the sun and the moon? No. But I can feel it. It's in my world. It's in my reality. And a lot of times to grow, we need that to feel it in our world. And again, I believe that's what Rashi is sharing with us. In any case, the next pasuk goes on. Or actually, I'm sorry, before we go there. Asa Hashem Elokim L'Moshe L'Yisrael. That which Hashem did to Moshe Yisrael. So Rashi makes an interesting observation. If you listen to the way the pasuk is saying, it seems to indicate that Hashem did this for Moshe and Yisrael, meaning as if they were equals or something like that. Says Rashi, that's exactly correct. Yisrael heard everything that Hashem did for Moshe and Yisrael. Says Rashi, Shokel Moshe Keneged Kol Yisrael. Moshe is equal to the entire Yisrael. What the pasuk is telling us is that these miracles were done for Moshe and for Yisrael. Moshe, by the way, first, to teach us this concept that if you have a scale, and on one side of the scale you put the entire Jewish nation, on the other side of the scale you put Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu is their equal. Now, this Rashi is very difficult to understand. Why? Because you could tell me that one man learns better than another, one man does more chesed, he gives more charity, you could tell me he's more kindly. But how can you tell me that one man equals out 3 million people? amongst whom were many great individuals, many chachamim, many even neviim, Arakoin, Miriam, Hanaviah. How could one human being possibly equal an entire nation? And the basis of that question is from a human perspective. From a flesh and blood mortal perspective, that is a very valid question and has no answer. And that's exactly the point. You and I, and the biggest mistake that we make, circles around this single point. We tend to think of ourselves as physical beings. Okay, I'm 5'10", you're 6'2", she's 5'4". We're physical human beings, and right now we're here. And you know, every once in a while we have spiritual experiences. You know, we daven, maybe on Shabbos, etc. And that is about as false and wrong as you could possibly imagine. Nothing could be further than from the truth. My body is physical. My arms, my legs, my head, my chest, that's physical. But I, the one inside, am not physical. I'm totally, completely spiritual. I, the one who thinks, I, the one who remembers, I, the one who tells my arms and legs to do what they should be doing, is utterly, completely spiritual. I have no physical existence. I am ruchni, I am spiritual. The proof in the pudding is every once in a while you see things that are interesting when science tries to measure things like death. Right? A medical ethical question, what constitutes death? Is it brain death? Is it when there's no respiration? I don't mean to be funny, but I'll ask it in exactly this way. What's so difficult? I am me. When I'm here, I'm alive. When I leave, I'm dead. Why don't you just use a simple measure? Am I here or not here? If I'm here, I'm alive. I'm not there, I'm dead. The answer to that question is that I can't be measured. You can't put I into a vial, add some blue dye and see what color it turns. You can't weigh I. You can't measure I because I am not physical. Now, I know I'm alive and I know I'm real because I've been alive my whole life, but I'm the one inside. I'm kula ruchni, completely spiritual. And once you're able to make that step, understanding that I am the one inside, like a astronaut who puts on a spacesuit, but the spacesuit doesn't define him. I am inside a body, but the body doesn't define me, nor does it limit me, nor contain me. Temporarily, I'm in it. For a short while, I'm here, but eventually, I'll leave it. Once you understand that, you can understand life from a very different perspective. You see, in this physical world, everything is limited. If you want to get in shape, you go to the gym, and let's say you want to become muscular. So you'll bench press, you'll do different exercises, and you'll put on weight, you'll increase muscle mass, and you'll become more bulky, larger, and you can increase strength. You might have come to the gym originally being able to lift 100 pounds, eventually it's 200 pounds, 400 pounds. Maybe at a certain point you'll be able to lift 500 pounds. You've become much, much stronger, all within very limited parameters. Another 100 pounds, 200 pounds, 300 pounds, because anything physical is limited. I don't care how many days a week you work out. I don't care how many protein supplements you take. You will not be able to bench press a freight train. You're not going to be able to play in traffic and just stop the vehicles because by definition, anything physical is limited and no matter how strong you make your body, it's a physical entity that has limits, that has parameters, and can only get so large and that's it. And that's one of the key distinctions between physical entities and spiritual entities. You see, a spiritual entity has almost no limitations. It's not limited by time, not by space, boundless in that sense. And when Hashem created the human, Hashem gave us remarkable capacities of growth. The neshama, which is I, speaking to you, is capable of doubling, doubling again, constant exponential growth. So you could have two human beings, both look the same physically. One is a towering giant, and the other one is a simple little man. And I believe what we're asking, Rashi sharing with us is that one time in history, the greatest man who ever lived was Moshe Rabbeinu. And if you'd like to know how great he became, if you'd like to know how many times he doubled and redoubled and grew, he became so phenomenally great that he equaled out an entire nation. His godless, his greatness was such that if you put 3 million neshamas on that side of the scale, put his neshama on the other side of the scale, he equals out. Now, you and I are not the measures of neshama. we don't know. But Hashem wrote the Torah, and Hashem is telling us that the importance, the significance, the weight, the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu equaled out Yisrael. And this is illustrative of how great a human being can become. Granted, you and I were not Moshe Rabbeinu. We're not going to tower over a generation. But if I understand that my capacity is huge, I can accomplish, I can grow. My biceps won't become much larger. My physical frame won't change dramatically. But the essence of I, who I am, can double and redouble. If I use my time right, if I dedicate myself to the system of self-perfection, the Torah, and I use the mitzvahs appropriately, I become larger and bigger, bigger and bigger. And after 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, and certainly at the end of a life, a person can be huge beyond understanding. And again, I think this Rashi is a very critical concept that he shares with us. The next pasuk says, "V'yikach Yisro Chosei Moshe et Zipporah, Eishes Moshe Acha Shiluchah." And Yisro, the father-in-law of Moshe, took Zipporah, brought Moshe's wife, Acha Shiluchah, after she was sent away. Now, we don't know anything about how she was sent away, where she was sent away. And as always, the Torah writes in very abbreviated form and almost Ramazim. Rashi explained to us what happened, that when Hashem sent Moshe to take the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu brought his wife and children with. He meets Aaron a little bit outside Mitzrayim, and Aaron says, "Who are these people you're bringing?" Says Moshe, "This is my wife, and these are my children." Aaron HaKohen says, "Don't we have enough trouble with those who are already in bondage? You're bringing more people to become enslaved?" At which point Moshe sent Zipporah and his children back to Yisro. There they remained until now. According to Rashi, and it's a machlokas in the Gemara, this opens up after Kabbalah Satorah. Meaning, there is a machlokas in the Gemara whether the parsha of Yisro, this entire event of Yisro coming, was before the Jewish people received the Torah or after. Rashi simply learned that it was after Kabbalah Satorah, and Zipporah and children are brought. But not only did Yisro bring Zipporah, she also brought the two children, one of whom was named Gershon, ki amar ger hayisi be'eretz Nachria, because Moshe said, "I was a foreigner in a foreign land." V'shem echas Eliezer, and the name of the other one is Eliezer, ki elokei avi be'ezri, because the God of my father was in my aid, v'yatzeleni mecherev paro, and he saved me from the sword of paro. The two children of Moshe were named Gershom and Eliezer, and each one had a particular meaning. Now, clearly, they weren't called that here, but because this is the first time that they're mentioned by name in this sort of opportunity, the Torah is taking the time to explain to us why Moshe Rabbeinu gave them the names. Gershom, because he was a foreigner, and Hashem protected him in Midian. Eliezer, as Rashi explains, because when Dothan and Aviram saw Moshe kill that Mitzri, Dothan and Aviram ran to Paro. Paro immediately brought Moshe on trial, determined that he was in fact defending the Jews against the Mitzri taskmaster, and Paro said, "Kill him." They took Moshe Rabbeinu to be killed, and various nisim happened. The sword bounced off the neck of Moshe. The guardsmen, one became blind, the other became mute, they couldn't talk, etc. Moshe Rabbeinu escaped, and because of that, he named his son Eliezer in memory of that fact that Hashem saved him from Mecherev Paro. Vayavu Yisro Chosei Moshe, one of Ishto al Moshe el Amidbar, and Yisro, the father of Moshe and the sons and wife, came to Moshe el Amidbar, to the Midbar, Asher hu chone sham Har Elokim, where he was resting next to the Har Elokim, next to Har Sinai. Now, clearly, there's a lot of repetition because we've already heard that Yisro is the father-in-law of Moshe. We also heard that the children came and the wife. So any time the Torah repeats, there's a lima, there's something to be taught to us here. We're not going to stop on every element of it, but one point that Rashi explains is that the Midbar was a accolade to Yisro. Yisro had been sitting in a lap of luxury. Yisro had been a high priest, very powerful, very influential, living in what was then considered a metropolis, and he left his comfort to go to the Midbar to learn Torah, to become Jewish. V'yomer Moshe, Yisro sends a message to Moshe. The Medrash Tanchuma explains to us that the Klal Yisrael was surrounded by anonim. They were surrounded by clouds. You couldn't get in. So Yisro couldn't just walk in and say, "Hi, I'm Moshe's father-in-law." He shot an arrow, and on this arrow was a message that read as follows: "I am Ani Choson Cha Yisro. I am your father-in-law Yisro. Bo Elecha, I've come to you. Vishtecha Shnei Vanecha Ima, and your wife and your two children are with her." Vayetze Moshe Likras Chosno. Moshe went out to greet his father-in-law. Vayishtachavu, he bowed down. Vayishaklo, he kissed him. Vayishalu ish l're'eyu, and each man asked, "How are you doing?" L'shalom, for peace. Vayavoa ola, and they came to the ohel. Now Rashi makes a very interesting observation that probably in the history of man, no human being received the kind of honor that Yisro received. Because Rashi brings down the Medrash that when Moshe Rabbeinu went out to greet his father-in-law, that was because there is a concept of a son-in-law treating his father-in-law with respect. It's a machlokas amongst the Rishonim, whether it's a full mitzvah saseh, whether it falls under the category of the same mitzvah of respecting your parents, but there certainly is a propriety to treating a father-in-law with respect. So for that reason, Moshe Rabbeinu, even though he was the melech, he was effectively the king, he was the Sar HaTorah, he was the master of Torah, he was the leader of the Jewish nation, and it's inappropriate for him to go out. Quite the opposite, send your messengers, send an entourage, but you, the king, you don't go out yourself. But because it was appropriate to show honor to a father-in-law, Moshe Rabbeinu went out. Is it possible, says the Medrash, that Moshe Rabbeinu would go out of the machane and would leave the camp and Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu wouldn't follow? Is it possible Moshe, Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu would go out and the Zakenim wouldn't follow? Is it possible that these people go out and the rest of the Jewish nation wouldn't follow? Explains Rashi, the entire Jewish nation went out to greet Yisro. Moshe and the Zakenim and everyone else went out to greet Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, and he was treated with an honor that's probably unprecedented. But there's one point in the pasuk that's interesting. It says, "Vishalu ish l're'ehu." Each man greeted Re'ehu. Re'ehu implies equals. And Rashi explains, obviously, Yisro was not the equal of Moshe. I'm sorry, but it's Ibn Ezra who explains that even though they were not equals, but he says, "Gadol malusu b'chokhma," because of Yisro's tremendous wisdom. Even though it's true, obviously, they were not equals, you wouldn't call them Re'ehu, but in the element of wisdom, Yisro was a tremendous chokhm, and as we're going to soon see, he gave Moshe advice that apparently Moshe didn't realize himself, and Yisro was considered a very wise and chashev person. Vayisapa Moshe l'chosno, and Moshe told over to his father-in-law, "As kol asher asa Hashem l'faro l'mitzrayim," everything that Hashem had done to Paro and Mitzrayim, "al odos Yisrael," for Yisrael, "as kol atla'a Hashem etzasam b'derech," all of the difficult situations that befell them on the path, "vayatzileim Hashem," and Hashem saved them from them. Basically, Yisro comes, Zipporah, the children. What does Moshe do? Moshe says over to his father-in-law everything that Paro did, everything the Mitzrayim did. Hashem saved us from us. All the events that happened, that's what Moshe told over to Yisro. Rashi on that pasuk explains why he was telling stories. Meaning, your father-in-law comes, that's very nice. You greet him, maybe you make him a meal. How are you doing? Discuss. Why is he telling him? Why is Moshe telling him the events that happened? Why is he telling him these stories? Explains Rashi, "Limshoch es libo l'karvo l'Torah." Moshe Rabbeinu was attempting to pull Yisro's heart to bring him closer to Torah. Yisro came to be Megayri, came to join the Jewish people, but I guess it wasn't a fait accompli, it wasn't 100%. He was coming to see, let me check it out. Moshe Rabbeinu had in mind to draw him close, to limshoch es libo l'Torah, to bring his heart closer to Torah. That's why he told him these things. What did he tell him? Rashi says, what he told him was that which Hashem did for us on the Yam and that which Hashem did for us with Amalek. Now that is very strange. You're telling me that Yisro came to join the Jewish nation. He heard, Vayishma Yisro, and Rashi earlier said, what did he hear? He heard about Kriyas Yamsuf, he heard the splitting of the sea, and Amalek and the war with Amalek. So that's what moved him, that's what motivated him, that's what got him out of his metropolis to come to the Midbar. What does Moshe Rabbeinu do? He says, oh my goodness, my father-in-law's here. Maybe I can really pull him to Torah. What does Moshe Rabbeinu do? The very things for which Yisro came, Kriyas Yamsuf, and War of Amalek, that's exactly what Moshe says over. That doesn't sound very logical. Tell him other ideas, tell him new concepts, tell him things he didn't know. Okay, I'm sure you share some details about the Yamsuf that he didn't realize. I'm sure there's some details, maybe even Kriyas Yamsuf he didn't realize. But you'd imagine that that's not really what's needed. And as a matter of fact, not only is that what's needed, I think Rashi is sharing with us a tremendous concept. There are many, many levels of feeling something. If you're in a distant place, you hear about this miracle called the splitting of the sea, it's very impressive. If you're a little bit closer to it, it's far more impressive. And if you're in the sea itself, it's beyond description. Moshe Rabbeinu was giving him an eye glimpse. Feel it. Understand it. Get into the channels themselves, and I want you to feel what it was like. And the reason that Moshe Rabbeinu was doing this was because he was trying to pull his heart to Torah. Rasul Salanta said the greatest distance in the world is the distance between the mind and the heart. There are many, many things that we know, and we really know them, but we don't feel them. Yisro knew, he had been told and knew about the splitting of the sea. But Moshe Rabbeinu wanted him to feel it, because when you feel it, then it will really have an impact, then it will really move you. And probably one of the biggest parts of our entire avodah is to feel that which we know. Everyone has emunah. I know Hashem is here. What kind of question is it? Until a little dog starts barking. There are many, many things we know intellectually. The avodah, the hard work, is to feel it, and to be margish it, to bring our mind and our hearts together. And exactly that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing. He was trying to influence his father-in-law, and that's why he told him over that which he knew already, but that which had moved him, but I want you to feel it more, have a greater sense of it. Vayichad Yisro al kol tova, and Yisro was moved by all of the good asher asa Hashem liYisrael, that Hashem had done liYisrael, asher hitzilo miyad Mitzrayim, and Hashem had saved them from Mitzrayim. Yisro knew that Mitzrayim was a very powerful nation. Yisro knew that Paro was a very powerful king, explains Rashi. In the history of Mitzrayim, no slave ever escaped. And as a matter of fact, the earlier Rashi tells us that more than all the Nisim was the fact that 3 million people escaped Mitzrayim. Not a slave, not a dozen slaves, not 1,000. The entire nation marches out. In totality, that was the most remarkable part of it. And this, in fact, Moshe Yisro heard, understood, and he was very moved by it. The Yom Yisro, Yisro said, Baruch Hashem asher hitzil eschem miyad Mitzrayim miyad Paro, asher hitzil es ami tachat yad Mitzrayim. Yisro said, Baruch Hashem, who has saved you, who has taken you out from Mitzrayim, who has done all of this for the people. The rest of the story, they sit down to eat. Im Chose Moshe lefnei Elokim. The next day, Moshe goes out to judge the people. Yisro says, what are you doing? Novel tivol, you're spending all day judging the people. You're going to wear out. They're going to be weary. You're going to be weary. Yisro gives advice to appoint judges, an entire system of judges with levels, an entire hierarchy. And after giving that advice, Moshe takes that advice. Moshe, in fact, institutes it. And then at the end of this little piece, Moshe Rabbeinu says goodbye to his father-in-law. He sends him back. Vayelech lo al artzo. And Rashi explains that Yisro was going back to be Megayer, to convert the people of his hometown, of his place, and he left the encampment of the Jewish people. What I'd like to do at this point is proceed a little bit into what's going to come after this. See, after this we have the Aseres HaDibros, we have the actual moment when Hashem is speaking directly to the Klal Yisrael. I'm not going to spend time on what it was like at Har Sinai. If you'd like to focus on that, Shmuz number 74 really spends a lot of time on the details and what it was like, the Kolos of Brook and the lightning and the thunder, the actual events. But what I'd like to do is jump into the Aseres HaDibros and sort of focus on one or two points, a few points that we can glean some interesting concepts from. In the third month, when Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, Bayom Hazeh, this day, Bo Midbar Sinai, they came to the desert of Sinai. Now again, according to Rashi, this is out of order. That which we're reading now really happened before Yisro came. Others argue, and others say that it's actually chronological. But in any case, in the third month of the Jewish people leaving Mitzrayim, Bayom Hazeh, on this day, they came to Midbar Sinai. Now, one part of this pasuk is obviously miswritten. On this day, in the third month of the Jewish people leaving Mitzrayim, on this day, they came to Midbar Sinai. Now, it's not this day. This day is today, thousands of years later. It was on that day, back then, that they got to Har Sinai. Why did the Torah use a wrong expression on this day? Says Rashi, the Torah is teaching us something fundamental. Mao b'yom hazeh, what does the Torah mean on this day? Sheyu divrei Torah chadoshim alecha, because the words of Torah should be new to you, ki'ilu hayom nosnu, as if they were given today. What the Torah is telling you is, yes, it was thousands of years ago, 3,300 odd years ago, but to you it should be like it's today. It's like you received the Torah today, you were at the foot of Har Sinai, you heard Hashem speak. It should be to you literally like it was today, and that's how fresh the words of Torah should be. And that's why the Torah uses the Bayom Hazeh. And this Rashi is quite difficult to understand, because it's a nice concept, it'd be wonderful, and even explains the Pasuk, but how do I do that? How do I imagine that I was there when I wasn't there? And more than that, Rashi's saying it should have an effect on me. It should affect my relationship to Torah. It should be something new, something fresh. The words of Torah should be as if you just received them today. Every day of your life should be a new day, and every day of your life should be like you just received the Torah today. There should be a freshness and invigoration. And it doesn't seem possible. And I believe the answer to this is understanding how Hashem created the human. One of the forces that Hashem put into the human being is something called imagination. Imagination serves a number of purposes, but it's interesting to watch it. If you've ever read a novel and you sort of get lost in a story, before you know it, you're in the Arctic. And you're being pulled by a sled, and it's freezing, and you feel your knuckles grip, and you're trembling, and you're shivering, and all of a sudden, crack! Oh! What's going on? You're reading a book. Why are you scared? Why are you shivering? Why are you emotionally drawn in? The answer is, when an author does a good job, he paints a vivid picture, albeit with words, but he gives the right cues, the right little nuances, until I feel that I'm there. And I could be in the 17th century as a pirate on the open seas, or I could be an Olympic athlete training for the next event. A skilled author lays the trail, paints the picture until I feel that I'm there, and amazingly, I'll have physiological reactions. If you're really involved in a story, your blood pressure may rise. You may feel your palms getting sweaty. You may feel nervousness. If you go to the theater and you're really pulled into a story, you may start crying. Now, you know it's fake. You know it's not real. You do and you don't. You feel it. In the world today, many successful athletes and many successful people use something called visualizations. Visualization is visualize. See it in your mind. See in your mind you're holding that gold medal. But don't just see you're holding the gold medal. See yourself as you pace through the race. Feel it, see it, sense that you're running faster than you've ever run. Sense it, feel it. As you give that last pump, you cross the wire and you're the victor. You're the winner. Visualizations are very powerful. They help a person feel it, sense it, and oftentimes spell success. But you see, what visualization does is it utilizes this power of imagination, and it feels real. It's not just something I daydream about. I feel it. And I believe what Rashi is sharing with us is that Hashem gave us this extraordinary capacity to visualize things and thereby feel them. It's quite within our capacity to see what it was like to be a slave in Mitzrayim. Chayev Adam Liruses Atzmo Kilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim. A man is obligated to see himself as if he left Mitzrayim. The Seder night, a big part of the mitzvah, is to imagine what it was like if it was me. I was under the Mitzri whip. I had to pull those heavy loads. And a man is obligated to see himself. I wasn't there. But you can imagine it. You can think it through. You can conjure up that image. And if you focus on it, it'll be real to you, and it'll have certain reactions. You'll feel it. You'll sense it. What Rashi is sharing with us is that it's within our capacity to use these powers to imagine what it was like to be on the base of Har Sinai. Imagine the lightning. Imagine the Har, the mountain itself shaking and trembling. Imagine the absolute dead silence when a kol shofar, a powerful shofar blast, begins. It begins at the loudest sound that's possibly audible without crushing human hearing, and then it begins getting louder. And what Rashi is sharing with us is that we could relive that moment and have a freshness in our learning. Does it come instinctively, naturally? No, but we use imagination all the time. Just watch people who daydream and imagine and have all kinds of feelings because of it. And what Rashi is sharing with us is use that as a tool. It's there, use it. And again, every day the Torah should be new to you from it. Now let's jump for a moment into some of the actual Aseres HaDibros. And again, we're going to be very just from point to point, only because it would take us forever to try to do all of them. But let's jump to the second of the Aseres HaDibros. The first of the 10 commandments that Hashem spoke out, number one is, Anochi Hashem Lakecha, I am Hashem your God, the mitzvah of Amunah. The second of the Aseres HaDibros is, Lo yeh lecha Elohim achirim apanai, you shall have no other gods, no avodah zarah, no belief in idols, none of these type of things. And then the pasuk says, don't bow down to them, don't serve them, because I am Hashem your God, kelkano poket oven avos albanim v'shlishim v'arvim l'sonai. I am a vengeful God, and I will pay back the sin to the children, the third generation, and the fourth generation to my enemies. Says Hashem, don't do what you're not supposed to do, because you'll pay for it. I am vengeful. I'll pay back you, your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. And the opposite, v'sechesed l'lofim, and I do kindness to thousands of generations, the Ohavai to those I love, the Shomrei Mitzvosai, and those who guard my mitzvahs. So says Hashem, make sure that you don't serve Avodah Zarah, make sure you don't go off the road. Why? Because I'll pay back the bad for four generations, and of course I pay back the good for thousands of generations. Now, Rashi's bothered by the math over here. If you do the math over here, you'll notice that Hashem pays back the bad for four generations, and he pays back the good for 2,000 generations. The minimum of alofim is 2,000. And says Rashi, nimtzes, it turns out, mida tova yaseir al midas paranias, and turns out that the mida of goodness is increased, is more than the mida paranias, the measure of paying back, punishing, achar achamesh mil, 1 to 500. Says Rashi, what we see from this is a very interesting equation. Hashem punishes for four generations and rewards for 2,000. 4 to 2,000 is 1 to 500. What this is teaching us is that the reward is 500 times the size, the amount of punishment. If Hashem punishes for four generations, it rewards for 2,000. It teaches us an equation, and the reason why the Torah is writing it is to teach us this equation, and that Hashem pays back 500 times as much as he punishes. Now, on the face of it, this alone is a huge, huge concept. Because every once in a while, you'll look in the Torah, you'll learn, and you might ask an interesting question. Imagine we have a guy, Yosef. Good guy, does what he's supposed to, learns regularly, davens, gives tzedakah, takes care of his family, does everything he should be doing. He starts a business, and it flourishes and succeeds, and after a while, he starts making money, good money, very good money. And at a certain point, things turn unexpectedly, and he's literally on the verge of bankruptcy. And his whole world is undone. And he finds this out, Erev Shabbos. He comes to Shul Friday, all broken, all worried. And Shabbos morning, he's like a sabrachan man. He doesn't have a concentrate. He doesn't know what's going to be. Musaf, he just walks out of Shul, and he asks somebody for a cigarette, and he lights a cigarette. All right, listen, good guy. Great guy, having a bad time, he did something inappropriate. Yet the Torah says, "Machaleha mos yumos," the punishment for what he did, with a straw, with warning and with witnesses, is death. He's to be taken to a second story ledge, thrown off, and then if he's still alive when he falls below, the gathered nation stones him to death. Now I'd like to ask a simple question: one cigarette on a bad day in his life, and you're killing him? Come on. Doesn't make sense. The punishment doesn't fit the crime. And the answer to this question is that we don't understand the impact of one action. We look at ourselves, again, as physical human beings. So whatever, I eat the right foods, the wrong foods, kosher, treif, do put on tefillin, don't put on, what does it really matter? And it's true. From a physiological standpoint, my blood pressure doesn't rise or lower because I wore tefillin today. If I'm wearing tzitzits or not wearing tzitzits, not going to make a difference in my cholesterol. Shatnez is not going to change my overall health. From a physical standpoint, what I do doesn't make that much of a difference. But if we were tuned into the upper world, if we understood the world of the neshama, if we understood that everything in creation has a spiritual counterpart, and that spiritual counterpart is 100% dependent on what we do, we'd understand the human was put into a tremendously pivotal position. When Hashem created Adam Rishon, He said, "Tein daitcha shalachriv alami, pay attention that you don't destroy my world." Hashem gave the keys of creation to Adam. Hashem said to Adam, if you grow, if you accomplish, if you use the world right, you will be the sustenance of the world because the spiritual element of the world is dependent upon you. If you use the world appropriately, it will have its fulfillment, it will have its reason for existence. You'll be feeding the spiritual level of the world. And if you turn to the other way, you will destroy the world. And in fact, one man, one sin, and the world changed. When Yosef smokes that cigarette on Shabbos, from a physical standpoint, he did very little. But he changed upper worlds. He violated Shabbos. That's such an impactful action that he's lost his lease on life. With all of the rahmanis that the Torah has, with all of the loving kindness with which Hashem wrote the Torah, he's done something so egregious that he's lost his lease on life. And that's the appropriate punishment because that's how severe what he did was. To be honest with you, you and I may never quite understand it, but that's what the Torah is saying. And sometimes it could get depressing. Oh my goodness, all these chivim mis, I do this, I do that, I could die. Oh, this is overwhelming. And then you read this Rashi, and you should say to yourself, wait a minute. The punishments are very, very severe, very severe. But the reward is 500 times the punishment. Whatever you understand about the severity of being mechalel Shabbos, of desecrating Shabbos, understand that when you keep Shabbos, the reward for it is 500 times what the punishment is, because Rashi's teaching us that there's a measure, there's a ratio, 500 times the reward to the punishment. So if you've ever read about a serious punishment in the Torah, whether it be malchus, whether it be lashes, or karis, or whatever it may be, no one understands that any mitzvah that you keep, 500 times the reward, and oftentimes just resisting an aveira. The Gemara tells us that if a person is in a situation where he could do an aveira, he's tempted. He's in a situation where he's tempted and could do a sin and resist. Nostan lom schar, they give him reward as if he did the opposite of that which he wasn't supposed to do, and they give him that reward, and to the tune of 500 times what the punishment would have been. And what that means in plain, simple language is, we're in an opportunity to accomplish, to grow, to do such phenomenally impactful things. My entire life, if I give stucca, it's a mind-boggling thing that I've done. If I do learn one word of Torah, if I do any sort of mitzvah with any sort of kavana, it's so huge and so life-changing that it is beyond our understanding. And again, just using this ratio, if I understand even an eye glimpse of what the punishments are, and I understand that it's 500 times the reward, it's very illustrative to the opportunity that we were given in this thing called life. But I think there's a much bigger point to learn from this Rashi. You see, the Siftei Chachamim makes a very important observation. He says, Hashem says He's going to pay back bad punishments for 4 generations, and pay back the good for 2,000 generations. Now, assuming a generation is, let's say, 20 or 25 years, explains the Siftei Chachamim, this cannot be. Because Chazal tells us that Hashem created the world for 6,000 years. If a generation, let's say, for argument's sake, is 20 years, 1,000 generations would be 20,000 years. The world isn't going to be here for 2,000 generations, not close. So how could the Torah be telling us that Hashem pays back the bad, evil for 4 generations, and pays back the reward for 2,000 generations, it's not true. There never was, nor ever will be, 2,000 generations. Explains the Sifte Chachamim that that's exactly what Rashi's saying. Rashi's saying the reason why Hashem wrote it this way is not because there'll be 2,000 generations, but because Hashem wanted us to know the ratio. That's the reason why Hashem wrote 2,000 generations, to show us that the ratio of good to bad is 1 to 500. Now you may say, so what? And I'll share with you, so what? What the Sifte Chachamim is asking is that there won't be 2,000 generations in this world. And what he's telling us is that this Rashi and this ratio is not speaking in the world to come. It's speaking in this world. Meaning, why didn't the Sifte Chachamim just say the answer is that Hashem will pay you back for eternity? Hashem pays back bad for 4 generations here, and your reward is for 2,000 generations forever and ever and ever in the world to come. The answer is because this Rashi and this Pasuk is not speaking in the world to come. It's speaking in this world. The punishments and rewards that happen in this world, besides the world to come, are also 500 to 1. And what the Torah is telling us is, even though you're right, the world won't really exist for 2,000 generations, but I want you to understand, says Hashem, that that's the ratio with which I created this world as well. Meaning, while it's 100% true that your rewards in the world to come are going to be 500 times the punishments, the concept is true in this world as well. And I believe that this concept is quite large and quite significant, and I'll share with you why. If you've ever had a headache or a stomach ache or a virus or any sort of pain or tsaras, worries, trials, or tribulations, you may come to a point where you say, wow, life is kind of rough. I have toothaches and earaches and shin splints and tsaras and worries and life is pretty rough. At which point you should say to yourself, wait a minute. Didn't Rashi say that the rewards in this world are 500 times to the punishments in this world? So if I've ever suffered any pain in this world as a punishment, then obviously that means that I'm having 500 times the reward. But gee golly, I don't see it. I mean, my life's nice, it's okay, but I can't say 500 times, wow, life is awesome, life is wondrous. And the reason why we don't see it is because we're blind. A number of shmuzim deal with this, shmuz number 2 in particular, deals with the fact that we don't appreciate that which Hashem put into the world for us to enjoy. Colors, sights, aromas, textures, hearing, sounds that are glorious, music, flowers, sunrise. When you bite into an orange, it should be an experience. Hashem put so much care and forethought into the experience of our enjoyment, and you have to train yourself to recognize it. But there are tremendous pleasures in this world and tremendous care that Hashem put in for us to enjoy. And if we learn to focus on it, then we'll be able to understand that we have tremendous, tremendous pleasures at our fingertip, tremendous things that Hashem has done for us. And again, we have to train ourselves. But again, this Rashi teaches us 2 concepts. One is, anytime you're worried about the punishment, and you should be worried because the punishments are severe, because the gravity of my actions are great. At the same time, you have to recognize that every action on the good side, or anytime I don't do a sin, my reward is 500 times whatever a punishment would be. And again, number 2, this Rashi is illustrative to teach us that in this world alone, the punishments and rewards also have a 501 ratio, meaning to say life should be pleasant, wonderful, and there should be a beautiful life that I'm leading. And if I have trouble and issues and worries, oh, they're there, but they should be greatly overshadowed by my pleasures and enjoyments. And if I'm not feeling them, then I have to train myself. I have to see, I have to train myself to experience and recognize them, and then enjoy that which Hashem put into the world for me to enjoy. Let's skip over to the last of the Seres HaDibros. Lo sachmod beis recha, lo sachmod eishes recha, v'avdo, v'amaso, v'shor, v'chomoro, v'chol ha'shel recha. Do not covet. Do not covet the house of your friend. Do not covet the wife of your friend, nor his slave, nor his maidservant, nor his cow, his donkey, anything to your neighbor. Now, lo sachmod, according to Moshe Rishonim, is different than lo sesave. In Devarim, when the Seres HaDibros are repeated, the Torah there uses a different expression, lo sesave. Sesave means desire, Don't desire your neighbor's house. Don't desire your neighbor's wife. Don't desire your neighbor's property. Lo sachmod, which is here mentioned, according to most Rishonim, is a little bit more complex. It's not just don't desire, but lo sachmod means don't covet, which means don't desire and plan to take it. And it is, if you covet something, that car, I need it, I want it, I'm going to get it. And lo sesave, don't desire, means you see his car and you want it. And lo sachmod is a little bit stronger. It means don't want it, desire it, and plan to take it. But in any case, this is the mitzvah. The mitzvah is don't desire and or don't plot taking that which your friend has, not his wife, not his house, not his property. The Eben Ezra on this pasuk is very, very eye-opening. Because the Eben Ezra says that many, many people ask on this pasuk. Many people ask, how is it possible? How could the Torah ask me not to desire? Imagine I see something nice. You could tell me not to steal it. Maybe even you could tell me don't plot taking it. But how could you tell me not to desire it? Imagine for a minute that you're into cars. And many people are. And imagine that your neighbor drives up into his driveway with a gorgeous brand new Lexus. And imagine again for a minute that in your currency that's valuable. And you say, wow. Again, the Torah can tell me don't steal his car. Torah can tell me don't let the air out of his tires out of jealousy. Maybe even the Torah can tell me don't plot taking it. What do you mean don't desire it? It's gorgeous. I love it. I want it. I'm not going to take it. Torah tells me not to take it. But how could you tell me not to desire it? And Ebenezer explains the answer. He says, I'll give you a mushal. Imagine that you have a villager, a very simple peasant. But he's an intelligent fellow. And one day there's a parade and the king comes, and behind the king comes the princess. Beautiful, beautiful woman. Explains Eben Ezra, the villager is not going to desire in a real way the princess. Why? Because she's so remote, so distant, so impossible for him to actually have her, that he wouldn't allow himself to actually think about being with her. He says, Eben Ezra explains, the fellow would say to himself, what am I, one of these fools who dreams about sprouting wings and flying? Because she's so distant, so removed, he won't even allow himself to imagine or envision physically taking her, because, come on, that's insane. That's so, come on, I'm not a fool. I'm not a nar. And explains to Eben Ezra further, for the same reason, a man won't desire his mother. A man can have a beautiful mother. There are some women who get married very young and retain their beauty. You can have a young man who has a mother who's beautiful, yet the young man won't desire his mother. Why not? Because from the time that he's young, he understands that she's not within the category of women that you desire. And even if theoretically such a desire might well up within him, God, that's ridiculous. He won't allow himself to have such a desire because, come on, it's my mother. Explains Eben Ezra, that's what the Torah is telling us, that you can control the objects of your desire. The Torah here is not teaching us to control our desires. The desires are what the desires are. There are other mitzvahs in the Torah that deal with that. But here what the Torah is teaching us is that you can control the object of your desires. There's certain things that you just won't desire because they're so ridiculous and so far. Just ridiculous. As an example, I don't think in my life I ever dreamt about a palace. Imagine me sitting on the throne in a huge palace with servants and marching band. People may dream about being wealthy, about having servants even, but that's so remote, so distant that, oh, what am I, drunk? And explains Eben Ezra, just like you wouldn't think about ridiculous things like that, no one understands that Hashem is the one who runs the world. That woman was given to that man by Hashem, and that's his property. That house was given to that man by Hashem, and that's his. And when you see that and understand that Hashem meets out exactly what each person's supposed to get, those objects become distant. And even if theoretically you see them as nice, as it, you won't let yourself actually desire sprouting wings and flying. Am I going to desire a princess? I won't allow myself to think those thoughts. And that's what the Torah is telling us. That if you work on your emunah, if you work on seeing Hashem actively engaged in running the world, And if you work on understanding how the mind works, you can control your thoughts. Now, it's not as malleable as a piece of silly putty, but you can train yourself that that's so. I don't think about those things. That I don't think about. That's ridiculous. And you train yourself that that type of thing is not something I think about. Hence, you don't come to desire it because it's in the category of outrageous. Hashem runs the world. Hashem gives the right person the right thing as they should get it. I wasn't given it. It's not for me. Let's go on. And this Ebn Ezra is very important in terms of general guidance of controlling behaviors, desires, etc. The world at large doesn't have a clue to how much a human being was given the ability to shape himself, mold himself, down to the base desires. And this Ebn Ezra, again, it deals on a little bit higher operative level, not with the desire itself, but the object of the desire, but the concept that I'm responsible not just for my actions, but for my thoughts, for my wishes, for my desires, is something that Ebn Ezra explains to us because it's within our power to control it. One more step before we finish this parsha. The very last pasuk of the parsha, I don't want to let this go because it's such a beautiful concept. The last pasuk says, Lo salav amalos al mizbechi, do not go up on steps on my mizbeach. Hashem says to build an altar, and Hashem gives us at the end of the parsha very exact ways to build the altar. And when you build the altar, don't walk up on steps on the mizbeach, on the altar, asher lo segala ervoscha alav, so that you do not reveal your flesh on it. Explains Rashi that when you would walk up the steps, imagine the mizbeach is quite tall, and what Klal Yisrael did was build a ramp up to the mizbeach. And the mizbeach, let's assume for a moment, it's as high as the first floor of a house. So to get up there, the kohen will walk up a long ramp. The Torah says, don't build steps. Why? Because if you build steps, when the kohen is going to step up, his legs will be revealed, because they used to wear long tunics. His legs will be revealed to the stones, and it's not appropriate to reveal your flesh to the stone. Therefore, make a ramp so you can take little steps, and you won't have to take a big step. You won't have to reveal your flesh. And then Rashi explains something very, very deep. Rashi says, even though, of course, it won't really be revealing, because the kohanim used to wear undergarments that used to cover their legs, but still, on some level, it's not covetic to the stones. After all, they're there, and you're almost like revealing your flesh, and it's not respectful. That's what the Torah is saying. And then Rashi goes on to say as follows: Reidvarim kal v'chomer, and there is a kal v'chomer. Look at these stones that don't have enough das; they don't have intelligence to be feel their embarrassment. I mean, the Torah says, don't take steps because you're embarrassing the stones. It's not respectful to the stones. But the stones have no intelligence. They wouldn't feel their embarrassment. And yet the Torah says, don't do it. Why? Since they have a tzorach, since they have some importance there, they serve a function. It's not you should treat everything with respect. Even if it doesn't feel its embarrassment, treat it with respect. It's not right otherwise. And says Rashi, kal v'chomer chavercha, your friend. He's created in the image of Hashem, and he feels his embarrassment intensely. Al achas kama v'kama, how much more so you should be careful. If the Torah is teaching us, don't lift your legs. Make a ramp so you have to take little steps, because the Torah is telling us anything, even with a purpose, you can't embarrass. Surely a human being created in the image of Hashem, who's sensitive, who feels the embarrassment, surely you shouldn't embarrass. And that explains Rashi, the kal v'chomer. Now, one very obvious question. Well, a kal v'chomer is not necessarily a system of logic. It's a system of drasha. There are 13 midos, which the Torah's nidrash, darshan. A kal v'chomer has an element of logic to it. Effectively, the way a kal v'chomer works is as follows. If Reuven, who only weighs 100 pounds, could pick up that package, surely Shimon, who weighs 300 pounds, surely could pick it up. If he can do it, he's light, surely the heavier guy can. That's the system of a kal v'chomer. Whenever you have a kal v'chomer, the Gemara always asks, or at least it's subject to, what's called a pircha. And pircha says, well, hey, wait a minute. Of course Reuven can pick up the package, because granted, Reuven weighs 100 pounds, but he's a weightlifter. He trains all day. He spends hours and hours in a gym. Shimon weighs 300 pounds because he's fat and out of shape. He can barely breathe. He can hardly get out of bed. That would be a pircha, a question of a kal v'chomer that shows that the basis of your whole argument is faulty. if you think about this Rashi, Rashi is guilty of at least that type of pircha. The Kal v'chomer doesn't make sense. Why? Imagine for a minute the Beis Hamikdash, the holiest place in the world. Imagine a kohen, a uniquely special Jew on a mission. He's going up onto the Mizbeach to bring a carbon, to bring atonement, to change the spiritual dimension, change the physical dimension. Leviim are singing. This is a holy moment. There are steps or a ramp. Says the Torah, the Kohen has to be careful. Do you know the object of holiness upon which he walks? That's the ramp up to the Mizbeach. Of course, there you have to be careful. It's a holy, holy object. A human being is just a guy. Meaning, of course, you have to be careful in the Beis Hamikdash when you're dealing with the ramp or the steps up to the Mizbeach, because that's one of the holiest objects in creation. How does that tell me you have to be careful about another human being's respect? Maybe over here you have to be careful about respect because it's very, very holy. It's the Beis Hamikdash. It's the ramp to the Mizbeach. But how do you learn from here? A Kal v'chomer surely to human being. And I'd like to share with you the answer to this question as an example. Imagine a guy in shul, and he walks by, and he sees a covering of a tefillin shel yad box on the floor. And he picks it up and hands it to another guy. And the guy says, thank you. The fellow picked it up and says, I didn't do it for you. It's kaddish, it's holy, I don't want it to be on the floor. What did that fellow just do? The fellow so missed the boat that it's hard to imagine. Yes, the cover of a tefillin is holy. Yes, tefillin are holy. But none of them begin to compare to the holiness of a Jew. That man is created in the image of Hashem. Do you understand the importance of that man? Do you understand who he is? You should quake in fear if you recognize the significance of that man. What Rashi is telling us is, don't you understand? Yes, the Mizbeach is holy. Yes, the Keves is holy. But we're talking about a human being. A human being created in the image of Hashem. Nothing compares to that. If a Torah is saying you have to be careful not to embarrass even the steps because as long as it has a purpose, you have to treat it with respect. Kal v'chomer, how much more so a human being created in the image of Hashem, one who's created mamish, such an important, of course, him you have to be so much more careful in. And explains Rashi, that's the kal v'chomer, and that's what the pasuk is teaching us by telling this.